Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Grant Wacker, on the lives and ministries of some 20th century evangelists like Billy Graham.
And this was the paradox of Billy. He liked the limelight. He liked being with celebrities. He liked playing golf with presidents of the United States. Yeah, that's all part of him. But he was also a very humble man, and he understood that his gifts were given to him.
Grant Wacker, next. The primary ministry of an evangelist is to proclaim the gospel message, inviting people to put their faith personally in Christ. This takes place in various settings, one-on-one conversations, churches, and large public meetings. Today, Dr. Grant Wacker will acquaint us with three 20th century evangelists. Two conducted the large meetings, Billy Sunday and Billy Graham, and one, Chuck Smith, was a pastor. Grant will also look back to the end of the 19th century as well to tell us a bit about Dwight Moody. Dr. Grant Wacker is Gilbert T. Rowe Professor Emeritus of Church History at Duke Divinity School and author of two books on Billy Graham, America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation, and his most recent, One Soul at a Time, The Story of Billy Graham. Grant, I'd like to first ask you about Billy Sunday, who was active in the early 20th century. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he emerged in the late 19th century and the early 20th century peaked in the 1920s. And with most evangelists, there is a peak period, and his growth was continual from about 1900 to the end of the 1920s. By growth, I mean his the breadth of his popular appeal. He pioneered many of the strategies that Billy Graham eventually adopted. The notion of urban crusades, for example. Billy Sunday used the best technology that was available to him at that time, and he tried to reach out to as broad a constituency as possible. He tried to be transdenominational, move beyond his roots to speak to many people, and he also established a tradition that Billy Graham furthered, and that is calling people to make a clear decision for Christ. Billy Graham had a strongly negative feeling about drifting. He would much prefer people would simply be clear about not being Christians, if that's how they saw it, than to drift, come in and out, okay? Billy Graham adopted that notion of making a clear-cut decision, and he got that from Billy Sunday. I think, and now there's a somewhat negative side to that, in that Billy Graham actually saw his roots more with Dwight L. Moody. Moody pioneered a lot of these techniques, strategies before Sunday, and that would be in the last third of the 19th century. And I think Graham looked back to Dwight L. Moody more because Billy Sunday was so strongly political.
Oh.
There's no question where he stood on the political map. Dwight Moody was more apolitical. He saw the gospel transcending the political parties of the time and bringing a message to the pulpit that was not partisan.
Now, Billy Sunday, if I could ask you, Grant, you didn't mention this at this point, and obviously it's not, maybe it doesn't bear exactly on his evangelistic ministry, but he was a professional baseball player.
Had been. Mm-hmm. That is an interesting parallel in that Billy Graham at one point aspired to be a baseball player, and by his late teens, he was aware that he was not good enough. He would never be good enough. He was pretty good, and actually he played in a minor league. For a while, he thought he could go on, but later on, he said, I just wasn't good enough. That wouldn't work out. But where there is continuity there is that Billy Sunday had this kind of athletic presentation, And Billy Graham did too. He was tall his entire life. He was 6'2", 180 pounds, and he worked, as we say, worked out all the time, ran, swam, played golf. And so he understood the importance of not only building up stamina in his own physical body, but he understood the importance of self-presentation. It wasn't radio. It was television. And he knew that the gospel should not be connected with the visible appeal of an evangelist. But as one of his associates said, it reduced resistance. I mean, Dwight L. Moody was over 300 pounds, and so I'm not sure how he would have done in a television age. But Graham did well just on that front, and I think he adopted that. He patterned himself to some extent on Billy Sunday's athleticism.
And Billy Sunday, in terms of, you said, an athletic presentation, I've only seen photographs, but he was usually in some sort of a crouch look like he was about to jump off the stage. I mean, is that the kind of presentation that he brought?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a kinetic presentation, and the media, the photographers, captured him in the most histrionic poses. And so I wouldn't take those poses as in any way normative of the way he normally was. But he certainly was dynamic, agitated. He used his fists and he flailed his arms. And so he was very alive. Well, Billy Graham did the same thing as in the early years. Now, as years went on, he tapered that off. But in the beginning, he was bombastic, and he hit the pulpit, and one person who, in those days, they didn't have portable mics. They had mics with a cord, and he would stroll back and forth on the platform, and Cliff Barrow would reel the microphone cord in and out. And at one time, Cliff Barrows claimed that Billy Graham had used up 2 miles of microphone cord in the course of a single meeting. Well, I mean, that was in the tradition that established by Billy Sunday, not by Dwight L. Moody. But that was very much Billy Sunday's approach, even though Billy Graham did not acknowledge that model. Nonetheless, it certainly was there.
Well, I'd like to ask you about beliefs. I mean, in terms of Billy Sunday, Billy Graham, I want to ask you a little bit about Chuck Smith as well, particularly because of the current film, but because of his role in evangelizing the hippies. But to get to that a little bit later, what were their beliefs or denominational homes, affiliations, in terms of Billy Graham, Billy Sunday?
I cannot tell you that with Billy Sunday. And I think that's interesting that I don't know. And billions, trillions of things I don't know.
Right.
I think the very fact that I don't know, and I'm a historian, would tell you something, and that is that denominational affiliation was not important.
Mm. Okay.
Now, with Billy Graham, we know he was a Southern Baptist. But I would be willing to wager that a very large percentage, the great majority of the people who came to hear him, did not know that he was a Southern Baptist.
And what about their messages? Were their messages similar?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, these were broadly evangelical messages, broadly evangelical in the great historic tradition of Christianity, and especially Protestant Christianity, that the Bible is our authority, and that we know from our experience and from the Bible that we are sinners, and that Christ offers a means of redemption, and we need to embrace that means of redemption, and this brings everlasting life. There's an ethical component that goes with this, a moral life, and a mandate to mission. With both of them, there was an end time vision. I think with Billy Graham, that became more tempered as years went on. It's not that it's not that Billy Graham said he believed less about the second coming, but rather he saw that was a controversial topic. The Christians differed on it, and he didn't want to get deflected into controversial topics.
Mm-hmm. Well, my guest today on His People is Dr. Grant Wacker. He is the Gilbert T. Rowe Professor Emeritus of Christian History at Duke Divinity School. He's written a number of books, including two, on Billy Graham, where I'd like to camp out on him and his ministry a bit, Grant. But first, I'd like to ask you a little bit about another person who many would consider an important figure in, well, in evangelicalism for sure, but certainly an evangelist, a pastor, that of Chuck Smith, who has become even more widely known outside of, say, Christian circles or Calvary Chapel circles because of the Jesus Revolution movie and his role in the Jesus movement in welcoming in, evangelizing the hippies, it seems. What can you tell us about Chuck Smith? Anything of interest about his background, about his influence, whatever you think would be would give us some color on who this man was.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to try to do that. The denominational issue with Chuck Smith is very clear. Where it was say submerged with Billy Sunday and Billy Graham. I go back to Billy Sunday. He grew up now it's coming. You know, he grew up Presbyterian, but again, this was a muted part. With Chuck Smith, it's very clear he was within the Pentecostal tradition, the International Church of the Four Square Gospel, and in time, his ministry evolved into a quasi-denomination, a fellowship, a movement of like-minded people that had not galvanized into an official denomination. So let's say Four Square Gospel evolving into a Vineyard Fellowship. I'll go back to the movie Jesus Revolution. I've actually seen it twice. I would urge people to see it, even if you don't find the theology appealing. I still think it's a very important movie for what it says about the times. This is the times when I was growing up. I mean, I'm contemporary with those times. I'm almost 78, so I remember those times very well. And I think the movie it's largely accurate. There's some slippage there, as there is with every movie. But it's largely accurate in what it portrays about Smith and about Lonnie Frisbee, who was a key figure as well. And what I think is really significant about Chuck Smith, and I'll condense that movie and what I know about him into a single metaphor, that is that he welcomed people into his church who were not wearing shoes. This is Southern California, so that's physically possible, all right? You couldn't do that in Vermont, okay?
Right.
Or Maine or something like that. But in Southern California, that's physically possible, but it's a symbolic significance that these were people who in many ways were marching to the tune of a different drummer. And Chuck Smith was able to make a distinction between what is central to the gospel and what is peripheral. And, you know, there's a saying that it's common within the Salvation Army, which is keep the main thing the main thing. And I think this is where Chuck Smith's genius lay and where his legacy will lie, is that he was able to see what the main thing was without being deflected, hung up, obstructed by peripheral matters.
So in terms of his influence, his legacy in the church and the culture, is it essentially that he showed us how to welcome people who are different from us into the church?
Indeed. And more than that, he took risks. And he put his own career on the line. He made himself vulnerable. Things could have gone askew in so many different ways. The whole thing could have gone off the rails, and in some ways it did. I mean, there were some extremes, not within Chuck Smith's own church or purview, but later on in the Jesus movement. But within the part of it that Chuck Smith since oversaw or led, I think it stayed remarkably on track and within the historic evangelical, in this case, evangelical soft Pentecostal tradition. I would call this soft Pentecostalism. And Chuck Smith was right in the center of that. And he made himself vulnerable. He took a risk. A risk for the gospel, and I can only commend him for it.
Now, when you say soft Pentecostalism, can you help us understand what you mean?
Well, I think their hard doctrine was shoved to the corners. I mean, Pentecostals. I mean, contrary to the common image, Pentecostals are not all about experience. It's not a Hallmark card experience tradition. There are many hardcore doctrines involved. The question is, how hard do you press them? Do you make them the requirement for entering into the fellowship? And Chuck Smith had very clear doctrinal notions, and particularly about the end times. He was a premillennialist. I could elaborate that. I'm quite sure he was a dispensational premillennialist. I'm not 100% sure of that, but my guess is, and that his understanding of the imminence of the end times was certainly part of his message. So that was there. But in general, he was more interested in making sure that the gospel was accessible to as many people as possible without offending them or deflecting them by technical doctrinal concerns.
Well, Grant, I want to ask you, and I thank you for your insights about Billy Sunday and Chuck Smith, and of course, Billy Graham as well. You've written two books about Billy Graham, One Soul at a Time, The Story of Billy Graham, and also America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. And I have a few more questions for you about him and about his evangelism and so on, but your familiarity with Billy Graham is personal. As I understand it, I read somewhere you attended at least one crusade, but more than that, you got to know him personally.
Right. I attended a crusade meeting when I was 12 years old, and and the only thing I remember about that event was it was Madison Square Garden. I came from a little town in Missouri. And as Madison Square Garden in New York, and I had never seen so many people in one place in my life, and it was just overwhelming. And the other thing I remember is how funny he was.
Really?
I remember laughing. Now, I'll have to tell you, I'll have to fess up. I don't remember anything about any call to Christian commitment or giving my life to Christ. I don't remember any of that. But I do remember that people were laughing a great deal. Hmm. And I would say that from what I do know, from my later exposure to Graham's preaching, is that he was a master of pulpit wit. He knew when to use humor and when not to. And the when not to part is that's an important element too. When you have people laughing, that's great. You know, you bring them along with you, and then you stop it. And you move them into another mode. So Billy was a master at that, and he'd tell little jokes, and they were corny, and he'd tell them over and over, and people knew the punchline, and they'd still laugh. He was a master at these corny jokes, but they always were very deftly executed. So that's what I remember from my 12 years old. Now, later on, my wife and I visited him four times. And when he was in his late 80s and early 90s, and these were in his home, Montreat, North Carolina. The home was on top of a mountain, Appalachian Mountains, Blue Ridge Mountains. And I would say that the visits were a mountaintop experience in both ways. I'll never forget them. And my wife had the same feeling. She's not a historian. I'd say fortunately, she's not a historian. She was a school guidance counselor, but she wanted to go. You know, this is Billy Graham. And we were both overwhelmed. And we're overwhelmed by the charisma. And that's with small c, but I would stress it. And that when you're in his presence, you just do. You're in the presence of a of a uniquely gifted human. And he was also humble. And I'll have to be, you know, I don't want to romanticize it. He also liked the limelight. I mean, there's a paradox there, right?
Yeah.
But, it, you know, the paradox of everybody. And this was the paradox of Billy. He liked the limelight. He liked being with celebrities. He liked playing golf with presidents of the United States. Yeah, that's all part of him. But he was also a very humble man. And he understood that his gifts were given to him. He knew who he was. He knew he was Billy Graham. He knew he was a forceful preacher. And he knew that tens of millions of people had listened to him. But at the same time, he was very clear that these were gifts and that he had not earned them himself. And he was, when he would talk about this, he would say this several times to us. He said, "I have no idea why God chose a farm kid." And that's what he was. He grew up on a farm. He said, "I have no idea why God chose a farm kid to carry this message." But he said, "God did. And this is, you know, both my gift and my responsibility." And he carried it through.
What about his contributions to the ministry of evangelism itself? I think you mentioned earlier, Grant, that Billy Sunday, in his day, the early part of the, or the late 19th, early part of the 20th centuries, he made use of technology such as it was at that point. And Billy Graham, I think you mentioned, at least in passing, that he also did the same thing. And of course, he had access to a quantum leap, much more technology than his predecessors.
And Billy Graham also had access to something that Sunday did not, and that's an airplane. Sunday's mobility was limited to basically to where the trains would take him. And Graham flew all over the world. This is a point I should make, too. Often is forgotten that after the mid-1970s, probably the majority of Graham's crusades were outside the United States. And that's a book remains to be written. I would encourage any aspiring doctoral student out there who's looking for a good dissertation topic to think about this. We're getting good books about Graham in Germany or Graham in Australia. But what we don't yet have is a good study of the scope, the global scope of Graham's work and his ministry. And I'd say it would have been so easy for him to say, well, you know, I've evangelized in North Carolina, in the United States, and in London, but he wasn't content with that. He was determined to see the entire globe as part of his responsibility. And, you know, the world is our parish, to make up a term here, of course. And he took that very seriously. The world was his parish. So that was an important part of Graham's work. It was a global vision. That's why he founded a magazine, a radio program, television program, and then eventually went into the satellite ministry, is to make that message as broad as possible. We see the same with Billy Sunday and with Chuck Smith. We don't want to hide the message under the bushel. Rather, this is a message that needs to be heralded as widely as the technology makes possible.
And of course, he's so well known for, as you said, for traveling the world, for preaching to who knows how many people.
I actually do know, Bill, is that the Graham organization was quite careful in counting. And he did preach in person to about 70 million people, give or take a few hundred. You'll see statistics saying that he preached at 225 million, and that's not exactly true. What that is that through landlines, he is preaching like what today, actually, kind of like Zoom. He pioneered, or his men he worked with, and they were, well, mostly men. They pioneered the notion of landlines and then setting up televisions around the country. So in a sense, people saw him live, I guess what we would now call real time. But in terms of person to person, you know, face to face, eyeball to eyeball, there are more than 70 million people who came to meetings and with their own eyes saw and listened to Billy Graham.
Well, obviously he was much loved and respected around the world, across kind of across the board, really. But he also had his critics, and you're one that's looked deeply into his life. What perhaps was a major criticism of either his life or his ministry, and then how did he respond to that criticism?
I think the overall criticism I would make is that in the middle years of his public career, he did get involved in partisan politics. And after the Nixon debacle, he bitterly repented. And he said over and over, I made a grievous mistake, and I hope other people, younger evangelists, do not. Now, to be fair and to be honest, he still fell off the wagon here afterwards. I mean, it was a temptation he just never could quite remove. But after Nixon, for all practical purposes, he worked very hard to stay out of partisan politics with, I would say, some, I'll reuse the metaphor, falling off the wagon, okay. this is one criticism I would have, is his involvement and his ability or inability to draw a clear distinction between the gospel and Americanism, and the American flag. He got into that. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, I think that was less in the beginning of his career. He was very committed to the defeat of communism. He did not see that as partisan politics, and I don't think it was either, because I mean, who wasn't? In the early 50s, pretty much everybody saw communism as both a political and a military and a theological threat. So that's not what I'm really referring to. What I'm referring to is how he came in to identify so strongly with the Republican Party. But he, to his great credit, he saw the problem, and he strove to extricate himself from it, and he repented of it. Hmm. I would also go on to say there, he never fell into any kind of immorality. Never a hint that he ever violated his marital vows, or financial integrity was absolute. Nobody ever accused him of bilking the public or being dishonest about money. So when it came to marriage vows and money, there's absolute integrity. He also, another thing he did that I believe is remarkable and important today, is that he refused to criticize others. He would criticize great movements. He would criticize, communism or materialism. He criticized isms. Mm-hmm. He would not criticize individuals. And he would say, my job is to proclaim the gospel. And I leave the rest of that to God.
Well, I'm wondering, for Billy Graham, what is his great legacy? Many people came to Christ and so forth. Maybe that's it?
That is exactly it, is the millions who came to Christ in different ways. That isn't to say everybody, had a profound conversion, at an altar on their knees. Some did. And that was authentic. In a variety of ways, people came to a reckoning of their lives.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Grant Wacker, Professor Emeritus of Christian History at Duke Divinity School and author of America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation, and his most recent, One Soul at a Time, The Story of Billy Graham. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Joni DeBrito on helping those with self-harming behaviors.
I think the most important thing is not to be afraid to approach the person, to talk with them, that they're typically going to feel as if you care and they're going to appreciate that, and to help them get help as soon as you can.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.